Coming up, doctors pleading for patients to write instructions in advance about their end-of-life care. And Father Damien, a priest to lepers. Plus, the new film, A Serious Man, a dark comedy that explores in a very Jewish context why good people suffer.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The surprising choice of President Obama as this year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace came with a citation praising Obama for goals familiar to many, especially the religious communities. Kim Lawton reports.
The Nobel citation praised what it called President Obama's extraordinary efforts to strengthen international cooperation between peoples. It said his vision is founded in hope, and the concept that those who are to lead the world must do so on the basis of values that are shared by the majority of the world's populations. At the White House Friday, Obama called the award a call to action.
These challenges can't be met by any one leader or any one nation. And that's why my administration's worked to establish a new era of engagement in which all nations must take responsibility for the world we seek.
Obama began sounding those themes during the 2008 presidential campaign. He captured global attention with a speech in Berlin.
In Europe, the view that America is part of what has gone wrong in our world, rather than a force to help us make it right, has become all too common. No doubt there will be differences in the future, but the burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together.
After Obama's election, he began changing the tone of American rhetoric on the world stage, emphasizing cooperation rather than confrontation. And then in June, his dramatic speech seeking a new relationship with the Muslim world.
One based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles, principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings.
And just last month at the United Nations, Obama invited the world community to join in helping him to make his vision a reality.
For the most powerful weapon in our arsenal is the hope of human beings, the belief that the future belongs to those who would build and not destroy, the confidence that conflicts can end and a new day can begin.
Kim, and the reaction from the religious community?
There's been a lot of reaction from religious groups, really across the spectrum, many of them praising Obama, but also noting that a lot of work still needs to be done to achieve this vision that he was awarded for. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Archbishop himself, a Nobel winner, said that it shows that Obama has really changed the temperature of the world, and everybody, he said, is more hopeful. The Vatican also praised Obama, noting his commitment to peace in the Middle East and also his fight against nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. And that is becoming more and more favored by a lot of people in the religious community, isn't it?
There seems to be a lot of momentum in the religious world around that issue. Obama has been talking a lot about ridding the world of nuclear weapons, and we've seen movements, Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. But interesting to me, even in the evangelical community, evangelicals are calling this a pro-life issue, and so there's a movement for their campaigning against nuclear weapons as well.
And a lot of people have been saying, haven't they, that this is an award not only for what for the tone that has been created so far, but also and particularly for what might be ahead.
Exactly. And it's interesting to me that Obama has really included the religious community in that work. And every single one of his speeches on the international stage where he talks about creating this vision of a new world, he explicitly mentions religion and the fact that he wants to see religion not be a force for division and violence, but for peace, for bringing people together and for sharing common values for the good of the world.
Kim Lawton, many thanks. In Washington, Congress awarded the Dalai Lama a human rights prize named for longtime Congressman Tom Lantos, who died last year. While in Washington, the Tibetan spiritual leader did not meet with President Obama, although it had become the custom for the Dalai Lama to meet the sitting president. Many human rights activists protested what they said was a snub to the Tibetan autonomy cause. White House and Tibetan officials said Obama and the Dalai Lama do plan to meet later this year after the president's trip to China. Also in Washington, the Supreme Court convened its fall term, with many of the justices attending the annual Roman Catholic Red Mass, honoring those working in the justice system. A controversy over a cross on public land in the Mojave Desert was one of the first cases the court took up. It's a closely watched First Amendment debate that could affect the future of all religious symbols on public land. The cross is now covered by a wooden box, pending the court's decision. As Congress and the president try to create affordable health care for everyone, one big issue is how treatment at the end of life might become more humane and less expensive. Right now, in most states, when a dying patient can no longer communicate, doctors have no choice but to keep care going, even if it's painful for the patient, very expensive, and unlikely to do any good. So, as Betty Rollin reports, many doctors want their patients to write clear legal instructions in advance about what they do and do not want done when they become terminally ill.
She's been fighting cancer for 5 years twice. She has emphysema of the lungs real bad. It's gotten worse, they said, since she's been in here. And right now she's fighting a bad stroke. They're not sure, but they're saying something like it could affect her left side and maybe her brain.
Did she leave any instructions about what to do?
No, she did not.
And that's a major problem, says Dr. Jeff Gordon, an internist at Grant Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Gordon has had dying patients who have not made their wishes known and haven't realized that some extreme measures are almost always futile.
Most people think that is for elderly people especially, that heroic measures like CPR and ventilator support is really effective. And the truth is, in older people with complicated medical problems, it just doesn't work effectively. So the bottom line is people suffer needlessly at the end of life. Ventilator, there's a plastic tube that goes through the mouth into the windpipe. And just imagine the gagging kind of feeling. Now, we give high levels of sedation to inhibit that, but that alone. Now, think of yourself, these people are typically there, have to be restrained so that they don't just reflexly reach up and pull that tube out. And so they have their arms restrained. They can't move freely. And think of yourself being on your back restrained, the muscle aches and pains that you would develop.
Dr. Gordon points out that sometimes aggressive treatment is a good idea.
Intensive care and heroic measures are awesome when they're used in the right people. The right people typically are younger people that have a chance of survival and having a good outcome.
Dr. Philip Hawley, who is director of the intensive care unit, says the state mandate is to keep life going, no matter the cost. So, although doctors think their patients should be allowed to die peacefully, their hands are tied by custom and law.
We have people who are terminal on aggressive life support measures. Clearly, they're not going to survive. We're spending all this time and money taking care of them. They're suffering, and it's completely inappropriate.
What people need to do is talk about this with their family, with their physician, in advance. If they get a life-threatening illness, a lot of times they won't be able to. Maybe they won't be coherent, or they'll be on a life support machine. They can't express their wishes. Then they put their family in a bind. So they feel guilty, They don't know for sure, and then what often happens is the sort of default is, well, let's do everything as much as possible.
And sometimes families disagree about what to do. It's hard for some to let go, which complicates things further.
If we could get families to deal with this, we would not have this problem. We feel that we as physicians should be able to step in and say, we got to stop the madness.
Lord, help us have that perspective. That's what changes lives. That's what gives us hope.
Dr. Gordon, who is also a non-denominational pastor, was surprised to find that patients who are religious often want more aggressive treatment at the end of life than others.
I've even encountered people that are people of faith, and they are what I think pursuing futile type measures, and they say, well, we're going to let God have his way here. And I try to, as gently as possible, say, you know, we're not really letting God have his way. We are forcing the issue here.
Has anyone ever talked to you about this?
Oh, no.
No, no. It's a topic that doesn't get talked about.
Dr. Gordon practices what he preaches by getting patients, as well as their families, to talk about what they want at the end of life while they still can. And he tries to make both patients and families aware of realistic rates of recovery.
I just want you to understand is that those kind of things like CPR and breathing machines in somebody that's got the problems that you have are not very effective. You need to decide whether that's something you would want or not, but you need to have all the facts about it, too.
One of the reasons conversations like this rarely happen between patients and physicians, says Dr. Gordon, is that physicians are paid to treat, not to talk, which is not to say that some don't talk anyway.
The person that needs to have this conversation is a primary care physician. They're going to have to call family members. They're going to have to gather these people. And besides that, it's a very difficult conversation. And so we're underpaying them. They're going to make a financial sacrifice to have this discussion, and then we wonder why it's not happening.
There are three things people can do to make their end-of-life wishes clear. Sign a durable power of attorney, naming a person to make decisions if they are unable. Sign a living will, which is about long-term life-sustaining treatments. And deal with the DNR question, whether if your heart stops, you want to be resuscitated or not.
Jill Steuer, who has metastatic breast cancer and has been given 4 months to live, has decided to stop any kind of treatment and receives hospice care.
I've been through all the chemotherapy, and there's no chemotherapy to help me anymore. I don't want to be stuck. I don't want to have any extra medications. I want to just go peacefully. The only medications I want are going to be the ones that are going to comfort me. That's all I want.
Jill Steuer is a nurse and researcher at Grand Hospital.
I've seen patients who have died horrible deaths, where their families wanted everything, the doctors wanted everything, but it was not to be, and that scared me. I'm not sure they realize that it's okay to say, I've had enough. Even now, people will stop me in the hallway and they'll say, keep up the good fight, keep up the good fight. And I think some people are afraid that they're going to disappoint others if they just say, let's have nature take its course. I'm putting up a good fight, but my goal is not to live a long and painful year or two. I'd much rather say at this point in time, I want the next 4 months to be as interesting as the last 57 years have been.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Betty Rollin in Columbus, Ohio.
In Wisconsin, sentencing for a religious couple whose sick child died after they relied only on prayer for the girl's recovery rather than also seeking medical treatment. The parents were each ordered to serve 30 days in jail every year for the next 6 years. A new study finds that nearly a quarter of the world's population is Muslim. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life puts the Muslim population at 1.57 billion, larger than some previous estimates. It also challenges some common assumptions. The Middle East and Northern Africa is home to only 20% of the Muslim population. Asia is home to 60%. Indonesia has the largest number of Muslims with more than 200 million. Pakistan is next with 174 million. And India third with 160 million. This weekend at the Vatican, canonization of Father Damien, world-renowned for his work with victims of leprosy. The beloved priest eventually died of leprosy himself. Earlier this year, Lucky Severson told his story.
This place may look like a slice of heaven, but to many who lived here, it was hell on earth. This is Kalapapa, which was and still is a leper colony on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. It is an extremely isolated place, forgotten by the civilized world for over 100 years. That may soon change because of the honor bestowed on a priest who helped the diseased of Kalapapa when no one else would. His name was Father Damien de Wister, a missionary priest from Belgium. He is remembered by another Catholic priest, Father Clyde Guerrero.
It's the story, the classic story of heroic virtue versus the worst we can be as human beings.
Father Damien called the numerous cemeteries on Kalapapa gardens of the dead. Almost all of the 8,000 souls buried in these gardens were victims of Hansen's disease, also known as leprosy. Its victims were first exiled here beginning in 1866, forcefully separated from their loved ones, treated as criminals, literally thrown off the boat near this rocky beach.
The schooner would park out there and they just throw them over. And if they survived, well, then they lived here.
When Father Damien arrived in 1873, those thrown from the boat, the castaways, lived under the most primitive conditions without potable drinking water. In shacks they constructed out of sticks and dried leaves. Food was scarce. Doctors would occasionally leave medicine but refused to touch the patients. Survival was all that mattered, and the place became a lawless wild land. Father Damien would change all of that. Father Lane Akiona grew up in Molokai and grew up admiring Father Damien.
He was the builder, he was the coffin builder, he was the grave digger. He did the services, he anointed them, he was their nurse and doctor.
Today there are only about 20 patients living in Kalapapa, where there is now a hospital and care is always available for those still afflicted with the disease. The place is still almost as inaccessible as it was in the 1800s. Audrey Toguchi, a retired school teacher, has made the journey from her home in Honolulu 5 times, always to pray at Father Damien's gravesite.
Oh, he's helped me a lot. He really has.
If Father Damien was Audrey's hero before, she's convinced he's become her lifesaver. After Dr. Walter Chang, a general surgeon, diagnosed her with a very rare kind of aggressive cancer of the fat tissues 10 years ago.
No, I told her you needed chemotherapy. Without chemotherapy, I said, the likelihood of you surviving a long time is extremely small.
And so Audrey made one more trip to Father Damien's grave, and here's what she said.
Father Damien, I have all these problems, and I really need your help to intercede.
After she returned from Father Damien's graveside, the x-rays showed her cancer was receding. Eventually, it disappeared altogether.
And Dr. Chang said, what did you do? I said, I asked Father Damien for help.
I said to myself, this is a very remarkable event. It's never happened before in as far as I can detect from the history of medicine. So I said to myself, you know, Mrs. Taguchi, I said, this is so remarkable. You ought to report it to the people in your religion.
Mrs. Toguchi contacted the Vatican and sent along Dr. Chang's meticulously detailed record of her recovery, which was thoroughly investigated by church authorities, who eventually declared it a miracle. The canonization process is not quick or easy. Father Damien was first officially venerated for his work on Kalapapa over 100 years ago. Then to become a saint, he needed to perform 2 miracle healings, authenticated by the best science of the times.
The first many years ago was a French nun. The second in 1999 was Audrey Toguchi.
To know that so many people went there feeling helpless, no sense of hope. And here comes this missionary from a foreign land and was willing to do everything for them. It is a spiritual place.
As long as there are patients here, the government will continue to restrict the number of visitors. But the patients are getting older. The youngest is almost 70. And when they're gone, only the gardens of the dead will speak of Kalapapa's dark, painful history. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Kalapapa, Hawaii.
Academy Award-winning filmmakers Joel and Ethan Coen have a new movie out this week called A Serious Man. The brothers are known for their humorous, sometimes violent, often strange films. In this one, they explore in a very Jewish context, without clear answers, the ancient question of why good people have to suffer. Kim Lawton reports.
I've tried to be a serious man.
You're going to be fine.
Tried to do right, be a member of the community.
You're going to be fine.
Please, just tell him I need help.
A Serious Man is a dark comedy that asks some universally serious questions.
Why do we suffer? If God is there and God is a good God, then why do bad things happen to decent people? And I don't care what flavor of spiritual person you are, or if you're a person of faith or not, there's no real good, satisfactory answer to that.
Religion columnist Kathleen Falsani is author of The Dude Abides, The Gospel According to the Coen Brothers. She says the brothers' newest film grapples with those theological questions in unexpected and, yes, quirky ways.
It's a powerful film, but it's a powerfully funny film as well. And in the Coens' 25 years of filmmaking, it's often their funniest films that are in some ways the darkest or the most serious spiritually.
Honey, I think it's time that we start talking about a divorce.
Set in 1967, the story centers around a Jewish physics professor, Larry Gopnik, who experiences a Job-like set of personal and professional calamities. He looks to his faith to make sense of it all.
Please, I need help. I've already talked to the other rabbis, please. I've had quite a bit of tsuris lately. Marital problems, professional, you name it. This is not a frivolous request.
He doesn't find any easy answers.
The rabbi is busy.
He didn't look busy.
He's thinking.
To their credit, the rabbis in the film don't really try to give an answer. I think they kind of encourage the wrestling out of the answer, which is, in fact, in my estimation, to continue to live your life.
The film is full of Jewish motifs. It's set in a community outside Minneapolis where the Coen brothers themselves grew up in the 1960s. They say with A Serious Man, they wanted to explore what they call the whole Jewish Midwestern thing.
The whole incongruity of Jews in the Midwest, Jews on the plains, it's just, it's odd, and that incongruity is something that we kind of wanted to get across, too. It's its own strange subculture.
They acknowledge nervousness among some Jews about how the film may come across.
People were really supportive, in the Jewish community especially. But, you know, occasionally people would ask, you're not making fun of the Jews, are you? This really deep Jewish thing where, you know, is this good for the Jews or bad for the Jews?
Like Larry's son Danny, the Coen brothers went to Hebrew school and were bar mitzvahed. They've indicated that faith no longer plays a central role in their lives, but they're notoriously reticent to discuss their personal beliefs or the messages in their 14 films.
They don't say a whole lot about what they believe or don't, but their movies are filled with theological and metaphysical and existential questions.
Falsani admits those themes may not always be obvious in what she calls the Coeniverse, the enigmatic and sometimes violent worlds the Coens have created.
I think there is a moral order to the Coeniverse, if you will. It might not be the moral order we were hoping for, but it's there.
A Serious Man may be more overt than other Coen films in its religious exploration. but it's no more obvious in its conclusions. Still, Falsani says in true Cohn-esque fashion, meaning can come by simply raising the questions.
I need help.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more about spiritual themes and other Coen Brothers films. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the Vatican, where Pope Benedict XVI convened a meeting of African bishops. The month-long synod will address poverty, violence, and the growth of Christianity in the region.
Omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.